Advanced Studio Classroom is on the air. Leadership teams today on Advanced. Hello, listeners, and welcome back to another Advanced Studio Classroom. My name is Simon, and you are joining me in the studio today with my co-host, Campbell, as we discuss our September management article. Hey, Campbell.
Hey, Simon. Hey, everybody.
Campbell, it's good to have you here with me in the studio again today. Do you want to tell our listeners what our article is today?
Well, as you mentioned, it is our management article for this month, and we are talking about getting the gang back together, which is an interesting phrase.
Yeah, when I first read it, I thought this was about organized crime. Yeah.
I thought it was maybe about a band or something.
I was going to say some might think it is about organized crime if it's about executive leadership at big companies, right?
Maybe.
Yeah, we'll give them the benefit of doubt, though. When we use the term the gang like this, we're really just talking about a group of old friends or people who have known each other for a long time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we're not talking about gangsters or organized crime. Getting the gang back together. Usually when you hear that phrase, because I guess it is a saying, right?
Mm-hmm.
Usually we're talking about like old classmates or old friends having a reunion.
Right, yeah.
But and here, no.
You know, it's usually fun, but here we're talking about something different.
Yeah, tell us. What are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about work, right? We're talking about building leadership teams with people you've worked with in the past.
Yeah, the danger of working with people you're familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think of that as too dangerous.
Well, no. It's probably not going to be detrimental, but there are some maybe downfalls to it that you can avoid.
I'll just say, Campbell, I don't feel that you are too dangerous. I've been working with you for decades now, and I want you to know I think, there's no real danger in associating with you.
No. Yeah. I feel the same way, Simon.
I'm so glad you do. Listeners, we're going to do three readings today as we work through this. If you have your Advanced magazine for September, I would encourage you to open it up and join us as we do the readings. If you don't have the magazine, you might consider pausing the program and going and getting one. It is the easiest way to support us here at Advanced Radio, and it's good for your learning experience, too. To be able to follow along and see specifically what is being said, go back over it at your own pace, etc. So, without further delay, let's do our first reading.
Getting the gang back together. The hidden risk of building a leadership team with people you know. You've worked together before. You trust each other. You know how the other person thinks under pressure. On paper, it's the safest move. In many ways, it is. Shared history creates speed, faster decisions, candid conversations, less time decoding intent. When CEOs bring former colleagues into senior roles, baseline trust feels like rocket fuel. But familiarity also introduces a hidden risk that undermines executive teams far more often than leaders anticipate. What I see repeatedly in executive teams built on shared history is the quiet formation of inner circles. Leaders who go way back share shorthand, context, and trust earned elsewhere. Others, often equally capable with deep institutional knowledge, find themselves outside that orbit.
Thank you, Linda, for that reading. Campbell, you know, as you read the first paragraph here, mm-hmm. what they're basically saying is that when you work with people, you know, it helps you develop trust of those people, and right. it makes working with them in the future a safe move.
Yeah.
Do you think that's true?
Yeah, for sure. It reminds me of the Chinese word muoqi, mm-hmm. right? Where you just feel like you develop a certain chemistry with people, and, you know, when you get to It's in any kind of relationship. When you get to know someone, you get to know the way they think, you get to know their thought patterns, you know a little bit of their history. So a lot of things can get done without having necessarily to be spoken.
Actually, you just touched there on the next thing I was going to ask you. I was going to ask you if you think there's a difference between people you've worked with before and just people that you know socially in terms of trust and, you know, that sort of thing.
It depends on how closely you've worked with people. But I think people are people and you get to know, you know, at least in the work context, right? Mm-hmm. You get to know someone's work personality, right? So you know how they work in the work context.
I think the thing is that when you have friends, you often end up working on projects with them, mm-hmm. even if they are not, you know, paid employment.
Right.
And so friends easily slide into the role of people you have worked with.
Right.
But I think the unique feature of people you've worked with before is that you get to see them in different situations under pressure.
Right.
And so I think that's how this sort of develops. But nonetheless, they lay it out for us here. You've worked together before, so you trust each other, and you know how the other person thinks under pressure.
Mm-hmm.
On paper, that makes this the safest move. So safer than what?
Well, I think the idea is that when you have trust with someone, right, then you don't feel like you are worried about them backstabbing you or trying to steal anything from you. And it feels like, you know, it's you're more protected in certain ways.
Than if you were working with strangers.
Yes.
Someone you'd brought in from outside.
Right.
Fair enough. I think that is a view that a lot of our listeners will share mm-hmm. through their own experiences. It goes on to say, in many ways, it is the safest move specifically because shared history creates this additional thing, not just trust, right. efficiency, really. Right. So they say here,
it creates speed, and that leads to faster decisions, candid conversations, less time decoding intent, right? And I think, you know, just biggest example in my life would be, you know, me and my wife, a lot of times I don't need to ask her. Right. I know mm-hmm. what she's going to say. I know what she's going to think. And I know what decision she's going to make. Right. Yeah. Because we just are that intimate.
Now, candid conversations there. When something is candid, it basically means it's straightforward or direct.
Right.
So you don't have to be too careful with the things you're saying if you know the person.
Yeah. I mean, with a stranger, you're treading lightly sometimes because you don't know necessarily what might offend them. You don't want to put them off. Mm-hmm. But with friends or people that you've worked with before, you kind of know where their boundaries are.
It's like with your example of your wife, you know what she's going to say.
Yes.
In response, presumably, to the thing you are saying, right? Yeah.
And you kind of know what you can say and what you can't say.
Mm-hmm. So it tells us then that when CEOs bring former colleagues into senior roles, baseline trust feels like rocket fuel. So baseline trust, essentially, that's like saying a basic level mm-hmm. of trust.
Yeah.
Why does it feel like rocket fuel?
Well, because then you don't have to go through all that time of getting to know one another, trying to figure out, you know, what are their buttons and what makes them tick and what makes them work. You know, you already know all that. Right?
So things move a lot more quickly.
Yeah, it's a lot more efficient.
Okay. We use that phrase rocket fuel to describe things that are of a special level of high energy,
mm-hmm.
right? Not just like normal gas that you put in your car, but mm-hmm. a gas that really makes the motor go. So an exceptional quality of fuel that leads to much better results.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have the warning. Familiarity also introduces a hidden risk that undermines executive teams far more than leaders anticipate. So I guess the idea here is that this is a hidden risk. Most people don't think this is going to be a problem. So what is that risk? Well, we have a person here who's basically explaining what it is. What I see repeatedly in executive teams built on shared history is the quiet formation of small circles.
Inner circles,
yeah.
So,
cliques.
Yeah, that was the word I was going to say.
Yeah,
cliques where it's just a small group of people that kind of, they have inside jokes, mm-hmm. right? They have their own kind of language, maybe sometimes little looks or smirks, the way of communication that maybe other people wouldn't necessarily understand.
Yeah. I mean, they go on to say leaders who go back share shorthand. That's what you're talking about, right?
Yes.
Typically, when we say shorthand, we're talking about like a way of writing that allows you to write down an accurate representation of what the person is saying without writing all of the words.
Yeah.
So I think a classic example is you would write the letter W with a line under it to mean with, or W-O means without, or B-C means because.
Yeah.
It's kind of a, there is actually a system for this, but here it's not a shared system that everybody knows or can learn. It's the result of experience in that relationship.
Right.
So they have all of this background history, and so others who are often equally capable with deep institutional knowledge find themselves outside that orbit.
Right.
That orbit here just means that group or that, circle.
Yeah, you just kind of feel excluded, right? They have a certain bond, a certain trust, and you just feel that even though you are just as capable of leading or having input, you feel that you don't belong.
Yeah. So there they've outlined one of the risks, which is that I guess you alienate people who don't get to be in the clique. Do you say clique or click?
I say click, but you say clique.
Clearly.
Must be your
Did you say click?
I said click.
During this, yeah.
I must be your French-Canadian side.
Well, I'm not French, but yeah. I mean, it's, you know, data. Does anybody say data? I don't think anybody does, really.
Data.
Drama. There we go. Pronunciation differences as we come into our second reading, where we're going to look at the danger of the four.
The danger of the four. I coached a CEO who'd brought three former colleagues into a 10-person executive team. Within months, critical decisions were being pre-discussed among the four before formal meetings. The other six leaders became increasingly passive, not because they lacked capability, but because challenging pre-baked decisions felt politically risky. The damage isn't caused by intent. It's caused by relationships that were never recalibrated for a new reality, and by new relationships that were never deliberately cultivated. The most effective executive teams consistently apply these four practices to prevent individual excellence from turning into organizational friction.
All right. Thank you again, Linda. Campbell, when I saw this subtitle, I found it confusing. I was trying to find some way in which that wording could mean the four dangers.
Right.
Like there are four dangers of bringing your friends onto the board. Uh-huh. But that's not it at all.
No, it actually
just comes from this example.
Right. Yeah.
So in the example, what is the four?
Well, the four are basically this CEO and three of his or her former colleagues that they brought into this 10-person executive team.
Yeah. So even though they're the minority of this 10-person team, they managed to dominate it.
Yeah.
Because of their closeness and presumably their ability to have candid conversations,
right,
like we were talking about before, and
yeah,
speed of making decisions and things like that. And so we're told here that the writer coached a CEO, and this was sort of the situation the CEO was in. When we say coached here, we're not talking about sports. We're talking about like a career coach or
an advisor.
An advisor. That's a good way of putting it. Okay. So our writer here is in the role of advisor to the CEO, who is on an executive team of 10, but four of them, a group of friends, including the CEO.
Yeah.
The other six, then it says, how do they react? Well, they become increasingly passive, not because they lacked capability, but because challenging pre-baked decisions felt politically risky. Okay, so when they become passive, It means they
stop taking initiative, right? So I think basically what's happening here was these four, even because they'd worked together before, they're good friends, they're close colleagues, they would discuss things and they would come to conclusions and come to meetings with decisions already being made.
Yeah.
You know, and because they were such a tight-knit group, other people on this executive team didn't feel that they had the freedom to challenge or speak up if they disagreed.
So if four people come to a meeting and they already have a plan in place to do it, you're in a bad position to come up with a different plan because it's much slower, right?
Right.
So I suppose the easy thing is just to sit down. Maybe you step back before you sit down, but step back, sit down, and just let it happen. You become passive. So you're no longer planning. You're no longer actively involved. You're just letting their plan happen. Okay, so that's the passive part. The next part there is not because they lacked capability. So they were able to do all of these things. They just weren't doing it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because challenging pre-baked decisions felt politically risky. Now, they've been talking about how this group of four knew each other before.
Right.
But they weren't making the decisions like way before.
But they were, I think what they're saying here.
So when they say, my understanding here was they're making the decisions before the meeting.
Yeah.
But not long in the past.
Oh, no.
Before they've been on the board.
Right.
Okay. Yes. So they're just, you know, it's like they're having a quick conversation.
Yeah. I almost imagine like they have like their own text group or something, or they have they have meetings before the meeting.
Look how modern you are. They got like a secret line group.
Yeah, you know.
It's like having your kids in preschool.
Right.
The parents groups are, all of a sudden you hear about something you haven't heard about.
It's possible, right?
Yeah. So, I think that's good. Yeah. So they're able to make decisions much more quickly than the broad group.
Yeah.
So they come to the meeting with the decision already
made.
Cooked.
Yeah.
Prepared, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the damage here isn't caused by intent. Well, what's the damage? Well, the damage is that you have 10 executives, but you're only getting ideas and input from four.
Mm-hmm.
So six of these highly skilled people are not actually letting the organization use their skills, right? So you're getting a fraction of what you're kind of paying for or having on the board.
Right.
That isn't caused by intent. And I think what they mean by that is nobody is trying to steal the board or hurt people or whatever. It's caused instead by relationships that were never recalibrated for a new reality. So when you recalibrate something, what are you doing?
Basically, you're setting parameters, right? You're kind of readjusting to the new environment.
Okay. And by new relationships that were never deliberately cultivated. So I guess if you go on to the board and you already know a few people, you talk to them instead of talking to other people you don't know.
Right.
Consequently, you don't become friends and develop the trust and learn about the abilities and limits of the other six board members.
Yeah. You're not involving other people.
Yeah. So that's too bad. The most effective executive teams consistently apply these four practices to prevent individual excellence from turning into organizational friction. These four. We must be careful here because this is not the dangerous four in our subtitle.
These
this
are
is
the a, good four.
This is actually a list of four now, not the four executives. So in our last reading, we're going to look at the first of those, and then, listeners, you're going to have to wait till our next program for the rest. But let's get into that last one. Linda, would you mind doing our reading for us?
One, connection. High-performing teams invest time getting to know one another, all members, not just familiar faces, before diving into business results, career paths, pivotal decisions, what energizes and frustrates them. This doesn't take much time. A small investment up front pays dividends for months. When facilitating executive offsites, I often begin with a simple My Journey exercise, using images rather than words to reflect career highs, lows, decision points, and at least one non-work passion. The impact is often immediate. Leaders who've worked together for decades consistently say they'll learn something new about their colleagues. Newly hired executives feel less like outsiders from day one, and everyone gains a clearer sense of how to tap into the talent around the table.
Well, Campbell, it seems to me we're being told to have barbecues here, basically, right?
Well, maybe. Okay. Get-togethers.
Yeah. I mean, if we're going to be a high-performing team, we need to barbecue.
Sure.
Not necessarily meat, if you don't like that sort of thing. But it tells us high-performing teams invest time getting to know one another, all members, not just familiar faces. Familiar faces, that's an interesting term there. It just means people you have known before, right?
Yes.
Like you know their face, you can recognize them. And they do this before diving into business results. So I guess you get to know each other before you try to deal with the business that you're there to deal with.
Right. I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier about the recalibration, right? When you add new people to the group, then there's a new dynamic. But in order to establish that new dynamic, you have to get to know these new people. You have to, as we were saying earlier, deliberately cultivate the new relationships.
For our next sentence here, I'd like to throw out the warning to our listeners. More of a reminder that, you know, we don't actually write all of this. You'll note that this was originally an article that came from Fast Company magazine. I want to say that because the next sentence doesn't look at all like a sentence to me.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know about you, Campbell. It doesn't seem to have any sort of recognizable structure.
No, yeah, I actually drew a big circle around it with a question mark. I was like, why did they say? And then I had to kind of take the time to process, and I was like, okay, I kind of get what they're saying here.
Yeah, so they're basically listing, well, what?
Listing things that you would get to know about someone, right?
Yeah.
So their career paths, like how did they get to their current position?
Oh, this is why you were resistant to my barbecue idea.
Yes.
Because you're not going to necessarily get this list from a barbecue.
No.
Okay. Because you need to know about their career history.
Right.
That's their career path.
Yeah.
Their pivotal decisions, the important decisions they've made.
Right.
And what energies
energizes
frustrates them. So what they find exciting and really difficult to do.
So these are things that you need to get to know about someone before you can work with them.
Got it. Mm-hmm. It tells us that this doesn't take much time. A small investment up front pays dividends for months. Okay. Well, that sounds good, you know.
So putting in a little bit of effort can give great results.
This is the part that excites me again. When facilitating executive offsites, I often begin with a simple my journey exercise using images rather than words to reflect career highs, lows, decision points, and at least one non-work passion. So, first of all, what's an executive offsite?
I wish we had more executive offsites.
So do I.
I mean, it's more of a just, kind of, I guess, like a retreat or a meeting where you're out of the office and you kind of are spending time, I guess, team building kind of thing.
Yeah, it's those things that are always kind of hard to defend because it looks like you're just hanging out.
Right.
But you're hanging out with purpose.
Yes.
And so it's important.
Yeah. Yes.
You're basically, the site here would be your office or the place you normally meet.
Yes.
Offsite just means you're in a different place. And so basically our coach, our writer here, is talking about this activity. And it's simple and it explores the journey of individuals. It's my journey.
Right.
The reason you're not using any words is because of that English idiom, right? A picture
is worth a thousand words.
Yes. And so by showing the picture, people can quickly kind of get to know the key things they need to know without getting into too much detail here.
Right.
So
again, going back to what we're talking about, career paths, pivotal decisions, what energizes and frustrates them. But here specifically, career highs, lows, decision points, and at least one non-work passion.
There you go. So you kind of get to know the outline of the person. It tells us that the impact is often immediate. So, you know, you're going to see a big effect from one offsite. That's what they're saying. Leaders who've worked together for decades consistently say they learn something new about their colleagues. Newly hired executives feel less like outsiders from day one. and everyone gains a clearer sense of how to tap into the talent around the table. I think probably the key to the success of this sort of thing is that relationships seem to be built through shared experience, right?
And knowledge, right?
Yeah.
Getting to know someone.
When I was teaching high school, sort of through Studio Classroom here, I taught during the pandemic. And one of the sad things about that class was that they were basically in high school for 3 years of on and off lockdowns.
Right.
So they, unlike other classes I've worked with, they really didn't have shared experience.
Sure.
And it was really hard for them to sort of create social connections and
relationships. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to just talk to a talking head the whole time.
It's like they would come into class and you can see them sort of sit with their friends or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would have somebody'd get COVID and everybody'd be home for a few weeks. And then they would like come back.
Right.
But it was like they were sitting with different people or not talking to their friends or like something had gone wrong.
Right. Yeah. Because I mean, I think a lot of the bonding happens outside of class time. Right.
Yeah.
And when you're online, you don't have that.
Yeah. Or even just, I don't want to say suffering through class, but, sitting through class with someone can be quite a bonding experience because you share that experience. Right.
Yes. Well, I hope this is not suffering for those of you listening to this program.
Oh. I hope so, too, because we have to keep going at this tomorrow, Campbell. We're out of time for today, but we have three more to discuss. Listeners, thank you so much for joining us today. We hope you'll be back with us tomorrow as we continue getting the gang back together. Until then, I'm Simon.
I'm Campbell.
Saying bye for now.
Bye-bye.